Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Yes, we're burning down the house here on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm Curtis B. Wayne with your weekly fix of topics related to design, architecture, and the creative arts. One of the emerging trends, I like to call it the wave of the present, here at least in the East Coast in New York, is the concept and practice of prefabrication. We see here in Brooklyn, well, not here in Brooklyn, but over there on Flatbush Avenue, that shop architects, you can check out our conversation with Chris and Bill Sharpless in one of our early episodes, have designed for Bruce Ratner a mid-rise structure of modular prefabricated units. Everyone's watching it with great anticipation. So it was really interesting to me when I was introduced through Steve Jenkins of Fairway Market. Thank you, Fairway Market, one of our best sponsors here at Heritage Radio Network. To Joe Tenney, one of the founders of Res4 Architecture. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Curtis.
Very good. Joe, tell us something about yourself.
I'm an architect. I've had my own practice with my partner Robert Luntz for about 20 years. We started in 1990. We call our office Resolution 4 Architecture. Often we say Res 4 for short.
Everybody seems to know you as Res 4. And I mentioned this in our studio, all the young guys say, oh, yeah, those guys, all right, great. In no particular order, these are the things, some of the topics I'd like to talk about, but if you've listened to any of our podcasts, you know that we're likely to wander off in any direction, which is perfectly fine.
That's good.
I want to talk about your new modular concept. I want to know whether it's a pun against Corbusier's modular. I'd like to know about your concept of working within the box. I'd like to know whether working within the box has imbued in that notion limitations that prevent other kinds of architectural expression. And let's see. Oh, and breaking the box. How, if you're working within a module, how do you break the box? Getting around to something that our teacher, Joe and I both had Peter Eisenman as a teacher. Early on, Eisenman had a course that he called Breaking the Box, which relates to Frank Lloyd Wright having broken the corners of the box with the cantilever, with the space that then becomes something that extends out into the landscape. And also a little bit about how your modules are, how they're fabricated, how that works in practice in New York City. So, Jack, if we could have a little break, 2 or 3 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Curtis P. Wayne. This is Burning Down the House here on Heritage Radio Network with Joe Tanney, architect of New York. Tell us a little bit about your practice.
Our practice, like I said, started in 1990. We do a lot of high-end residential work. We call them urban domestic spaces. A lot of long linear lofts, actually, a lot of apartment renovations. We started our practice by doing kitchens and bathrooms, like any
young... It's a good place to start.
As most young, small practices start out in New York City, you don't get a chance to do a lot of buildings. So that's how we started, but we started with the intent of making an architecture out of those bathrooms and kitchens, and putting our energy and effort into that. And over time, then we started doing additions, and then we started doing freestanding homes outside the city, additions and renovations to townhouses and brownstones. Right now we're doing a ground-up infill 5,000 square foot project in Park Slope.
Okay, but everybody knows you as the modular people, I think.
Yes, we've been fortunate to have gotten a lot of airtime based on our modular work. And that sort of started, or at least the big light was shined on our work when we won the Dwell Home competition back in 2003.
That's great. How did you, I mean, I think of those Dwell conversations as kind of a little bit bogus. Was it not bogus?
I don't think it was bogus. I think it was actually pretty important for the first time.
Important for you.
Well, I think it was.
But it wasn't a setup.
No.
It was a real competition.
It was a real competition. Dwell Magazine invited 16 architects from around the world who had participated or explored or was familiar in some way or another with prefab to design a modern prefab home that could be mass produced, had a real site, a real client, and a real budget. And we were fortunate before starting the competition that we had actually had developed a system, an idea, a concept that we call the modern modular.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't, what we had developed wasn't intended to be a product or a house to be sold or purchased or deployed for everybody in every location. But instead, as architects, we focused on an idea, a concept, and we developed a system that we designed within the limits of the modular industry. So we could therefore...
You mean house trailers?
Well, actually, I mean, we should talk a little bit about the space of prefab, because there are quite a few misconceptions. And within this space, there's basically three tiers. And house trailers actually don't even fall into it. They're at the bottom. At one end of the spectrum, I'm going to say, is the manufactured housing that adheres to the HUD codes. That's actually a legitimate, affordable option for many people in America.
Right.
And as you may or may not know, it's on chassis. You know, you lease it. You don't really, you know, you lease the land that's under it.
So I didn't
like a
know
car.
That.
So like a car, as soon as you drive it off the lot, so to speak, it starts to decrease in value.
Well, wait, that's like trailers.
Well, you could call them trailers, but actually, if you really look at the way they're made, the materials that are used and the process, it's actually a step up from a trailer, but that's often what they're labeled. So at one end of the spectrum, we have manufactured housing
right. That
adheres to HUD regulations.
That's the lowest common denominator of prefab. Then.
Yes, yes. At the high end or the far end of the spectrum is what you have kit of parts or panelized delivery method. And what's interesting about that method of delivery, you've got ultimate freedom as an architect, pretty much. But at the end of the day, when the home is finally constructed, the costs are very comparable to a site-built home, we have found. But in the middle of this spectrum is the modular industry, an industry it has to adhere to all the local codes. But what we found that it was basically it was a natural extension of our office. In other words, it was a natural extension of our practice. We had a kindred spirit with the limits imposed by the Department of Transportation of what you're allowed to ship down the highway on the back of a truck.
So... what, 12 to 15 feet wide, something like that?
It varies per county across the country, but generally it's 16 feet wide. Most modular homes are built to 14 foot, 12s and 14s. 16 is not common in general for the modular industry. It's what we believe is the most optimum dimension for domesticity.
Yeah, so our studio here, these are shorties.
These are eights. This is a shipping container.
That's right.
Yes.
It's about 20 feet long, and I don't know if they're eights.
This is 8 feet.
Okay. You would know.
Yeah. So these dimensions are optimum for shipping things on the back of a truck because they're within the limits, but they're not optimum for domesticity.
No, that's a very small dimension.
Yes.
Right. So, but you've not taken the route of the panelized construction.
We have built many homes using panelized methods of delivery, either open panel or SIPS panel, even foundation walls we've had prefabricated.
Yeah, you can do that these days, right?
Yep, it's becoming more and more common. So we have built a number of homes. In fact, we've built homes from Maine to Hawaii using modular, panelized, and hybrid delivery methods.
Okay, so let's get back to your kit of parts approach. Every architect, of course, has his or her kit of techniques of making space that they have discovered and they like.
Mm-hmm.
Certain ways that they make a room or a kitchen, which might not be a room, might mm-hmm. be just appliances that are arranged in a space.
Mm-hmm.
I myself live that way. My kitchen is a blister on the side of the living room, and so cooking comes out into a table, which is the table.
Mm-hmm.
It's the prep table, and it's also where we eat. The stove and the sink happen to be in that alcove, but it all just spills over, which is fine for me, because as architects, everyone wants to hang out in the kitchen anyway.
That's right. It's where the best parties are.
So why not have the kitchen be part of the living room?
We consider the kitchen as the focal point, or actually the plan generator. We would think the kitchen as the, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright, we used to talk about the fireplace as the hearth, the focal point, the center of the home. We think of the kitchen island as such. Even in lofts, even in apartments in the city, even if you don't cook, you order Chinese or pizza,
and
it always
hangs around
on the kitchen island.
That's right.
Yes, yes.
Even if there's not fire there.
That's right.
If we're right, the fireplace was this sacramental, almost tokonoma in the living room.
Yes.
Because the kitchens were where the servants were doing what they were doing.
Yes.
But that was that's a 19th century.
Times have changed.
They have changed a lot.
Yes.
So are these modern modules based on the 14 to 16 foot width?
They are.
Or do you break it down into smaller modules?
We do. We break them down into what we call essential elements of domesticity. Again, going right back down.
It sounds like archy speak.
It can be perceived that way, yes. And I will, to even talk more archy speak, this whole concept, all of the homes that we've produced, and I've brought you a little book of some of them.
Oh, cool.
It's our
first
pass.
This is wonderful. It's
it's a first pass at a rough draft.
For those of you who don't have television, it's it's about 8x10. No, 7x9, maybe. Perfect bound. White cover. Glossy. Very nice. About a scant 3/4 inch thick. Very nice. On the spine, it says Res4 Prefabs, the modern modular by Resolution 4 Architecture.
Yeah, I have to say that is our first pass at a rough draft. We're working on a real book right now with Princeton Architectural Press, but
that's great.
I wanted to just bring that.
Thank you. Can I keep this?
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
It basically has a series of projects, not all of them, that just represent the body of work that attempt to show that each house is specific for each client and specific to each site.
Well, I mean, this looks like it is definitely world-changing. Let's, Jack, let's take another 3 or 4 minute break while I go through the book here and have more questions.
nation keeps on bleeding. Nation bleeding, still more bleeding.
I'd love to change the world. That was Alvin Lee in 10 Years After. It's before your time, Joe.
Yes.
That's ancient music. We're talking about the Modern Modular with Joe Tanney from Residential 4 Architecture, Res 4.
Resolution.
What did I say? Reservation?
That's close.
Yeah, I'm
it's
sorry.
Good.
I'm sorry.
The res part works.
How about reservation? Well, you know, like...
Revolution.
Revolution. Revolution would be good. Revolution, resolution.
It's actually more of an evolution.
Evolution is good.
And not a...
So I see... I mean, what you're doing here is... very familiar to me, because it has a lot of referential orthogonality that we see in Aalto, a lot of use of wood, but it all breaks down to, I don't want to be totally rude here, but I'm going to be a little bit abrupt, stacking up modular housing pieces.
Yes.
I mean, I did some work when I had my own firm in Connecticut, for these Greenwich developers, and they do a neo-Georgian house out of modules. Design the house, slice it into chunks, mm-hmm. have it manufactured, have it shipped to the site, mm-hmm. bolt it together, put shingles on it or clapboard, and there you're done.
Yes.
Here, you're expressing the module.
Yes. Yes, the finished product is the aesthetic of the finished product is of the process by which it's been made. And the process, what you just, you know, referred to are these mansions that attempt to look like a builder home.
Yep.
And the aesthetic of them attempts to be something that someone thinks they should be building or living in or selling. And what's happened across America, these single family homes, we basically have produced these graveyards of complacency, these little tombstones.
Ooh, I like that. Graveyards of complacency.
That just march all over this sprawling domestic landscape. And in the big picture, what we would really like to do is get an opportunity to transform the aesthetic of the American domestic landscape. And yes,
well, these
we are
very lean and they're tight.
We think of them as lean, mean, and clean and green.
Here's a project. It says swing line, like the stapler.
Our clients thought it looked like a big stapler.
Well, that's okay. And in plan, it's L-shaped above and below. You've crossed the axis here, so you've got a double wide.
Yes.
By it looks like a little bit slightly wider thing. So this must be two
20
modules.
That's right, 16 foot in width, and that particular living room box is 22 feet wide. That's as wide as we can go with a flitch plate and not violate the bottom or the top of the structure in terms of the ceiling height or the height in which we need to ship it down the highway.
Is this on your website?
Yes, it is.
How would you find that?
By going to www.re4a.com and clicking on, we have a little
by
filters
location.
To the left.
Yeah.
No, just by clicking on, you know, projects and clicking on prefab and then scrolling and seeing the various projects we've done.
Okay, I encourage the listeners to try to find... Where is this located?
This one is out in the Hamptons, actually.
Uh-huh.
We've done a handful of projects out on the East End.
Which Hampton?
This is in Southampton, actually.
Wainscott,
yeah.
Okay. Cool. And it's sited on site.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So the studded out
all the framing
modules.
Yep. All the framing, all of the windows, all of the insulation, all of the 90% of the sheetrock, all of the cabinets, countertops, plumbing fixtures, electrical outlets, plates, lights, light switches are
so these are pre-wired.
Oh yes.
So from module to module, you've got some sort of junction boxes that made up.
We have done a couple of projects like that, but no. We actually do feed all the way back to the electrical panel. It's a home run all the way back to the electrical panel.
So each module is a home run.
Yes, each.
In the ceiling space or
in
under?
The ceiling space, it comes down. It's all coordinated in the process. So, and you know, you talked about some of the things that happen on site. Now you're talking about some of the things that happen in the factory. So, there's a methodology, a system, a process that we employ in the design process, in the fabrication process, and then once it's on site to actually finish it off. So we have a series of standards. You mentioned, you know, stacking a bunch of boxes.
Yeah.
We do have a system, a methodology by which we operate, and there are a lot of similarities. Again, the intention is that we use this system to create a series that can be deployed specifically for each site and each client. But there are standard components, standard details, standard materials, standard ways in which we operate.
So do you make a module that is a kitchen with an island?
Yes.
And do you make another module that's like a single-loaded corridor with a bathroom?
Yes. And what the modules, there's, I want to talk a little bit about the difference, the conceptual modules and then the actual modules. Because we design these using these conceptual building blocks we call modules of use. And basically, there's a communal module of use, kitchen, dining, living, and private modules of use that have bedrooms and bathrooms. And sort of that way of thinking, that way of organizing, actually was born out of our having done, you know, urban domestic spaces, these long linear lofts where we've had to think inside the box, where we're given the limits and then we had to operate, use our discretion within. And that experience of having done that in Manhattan now for quite some time, where, as we know, every inch, every space is a luxury, coupled with our research into the methods of prefabrication is what's produced this concept.
Yeah, you've introduced two things that I want to get into in some depth. One is there are limitations as to how big a chunk of stuff you can move into a Manhattan building.
Yes.
The streets are narrow.
Well,
you don't want to have crane time, so... above the first floor,
everything you see in the book,
yeah,
except one, has been outside of the limits of the city. We've only done one modular project to date in the city, and that's in the Bronx. So
these big modules came out of your loft experience.
Yes,
but
these are
do lofts this way.
Well, we conceive of lofts in terms of zones of use. You know, you were talking about food prep and food consumption.
Sure.
That's exactly what we think of. We think of the kitchen as a zone for food preparation, the dining is a zone for food consumption, the living room for the zone for food digestion.
Oh, I'm old school. I like the... 20th century old school. I don't mean 19th century old school. I like these things to blur.
Yes.
You know, I like the idea of the chef's table.
Well, multiple, working in Manhattan, you definitely need to learn how to have multiple uses, overlapping zones. Rarely do we have enough room for single uses.
Well, that was the rallying cry for how do you make something better when I was in school, which is that things needed to be multi-purpose.
Yes.
Because in the 1970s, when I was in architecture school, budgets were tight. Sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah. Some things don't change.
Yeah, exactly. And... resources were perceived as being scarce.
Yeah.
They were even telling us that, oh, geez, guys, we're mostly guys, you got to think about more traditional finishing materials because by 1983, we'll be out of gypsum, there'll be no more sheetrock.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay.
Well, that
wasn't true, but...
That would lead me... We definitely think of these projects or this overall idea under this notion of efficiency of use, which we were just talking about, the overlapping uses, which is basically design.
Mm-hmm.
Also the efficiency of implementation, which is the use of materials.
Uh-huh.
And what's become a preoccupation for us most recently is this efficiency of performance, where we're using in a number of projects a lot of solar photovoltaics and geothermal.
Uh-huh.
Half a dozen projects we've done where we've done a co-generational system.
In a house?
Yes. Single family home. Where
put in a gas turbine?
No. Solar panels. Right? Yeah. We're drinking in the sun, and the geothermal is taking leveraging the constant energy of the earth. So we're heating and cooling the home via the sun and the earth, and most recently we're doing
a PVA cogen sort of system. Okay.
And most recently we're doing a couple projects with chillers, so we're actually using the air.
Wow.
So we have a couple in the works using that that method.
That's big bucks for a house.
Actually, when you weigh them and you understand and compare and contrast to typical systems relative to their performance over time, it's actually a pretty high value proposition.
Over time.
So yeah, that's the other aspect about this body of work, why we've been doing or having built a number of things, you know, leveraging offsite fabrication methodologies is we found them to be a higher value proposition.
Which gets to my other question that just came up, which is, so who's making this stuff and where?
Well, if you go back to the sort of three tiers within the space of prefab I was talking about, in this, in the middle, there's the modular industry. It's been around for a while.
Yeah.
There's probably maybe 200 factories across the country that exist.
How about around New York?
Around New York, what we found in the Northeast has the highest quantity and the highest quality of single-family wood-framed modular manufacturers. The highest percentage of single-family homes built using the modular method of delivery happen in the Northeast. And when you think about it, it's pretty obvious. The building season is the shortest.
Yeah, and also the labor cost for skilled framing carpenters is high, and finishing carpenters.
So the industry sort of has its best and its brightest in the Northeast, and predominantly actually in Pennsylvania. You'll find the highest concentration of quality modular manufacturers. The further south and the further west you go, they literally vaporize in quantity and quality. By the time you get out to Indiana, that's predominantly the manufactured home. And by the time you get out to the West Coast, there's very few given the territory, given the geography.
By manufactured home, you mean
what you would call a trailer,
mobile housing.
Yes, yeah.
Which moves once, right?
Yes.
And it sits in a trailer park and attracts magnets of tornado action. Yes, the tornado magnet phenomenon. We know about that.
Yes.
I have
that's the image everyone
I have relatives
has
in the Midwest, and we know that tornadoes seem only to head for poorly built construction. Yeah. I don't know what that is.
Well, in the modular industry, there are a number of factories that are actually pretty high on the totem pole in terms of their quality.
Yeah.
I would say there are, we've built with half a dozen at least, but not all of them are capable of building homes at the level you see in the book or on our website.
So when you're working in this way, do your clients come to you because of the way that you work?
We have had many inquiries, yes, because they've seen the work in one place or another, and are interested, and they'll send us an email or give us a phone call or stop by the office, and we'll have a discussion about the pros and cons relative to what their needs are, what their site is, what their budget is, and what it is we're trying to achieve. Again, we have found using the modular delivery method for a single family home to be a very high value proposition. And
high value how?
It is cheaper to use this method versus site build, say, especially in the Hamptons, where labor rates are much higher.
And it's also hard to find people to actually do it.
There are in the Hamptons, specifically, there's actually a good number of quality contractors.
Yeah, but
out
not
there.
A lot.
But they cost a lot of money.
I designed the Bridgehampton National Bank headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
That neo-Georgian thing on Montauk Highway. Do you know it?
I was just out there on Thursday. I should have looked for it.
It's kind of
hard
right
to miss.
Yeah, it's this. brick thing on the north side of the highway just as you enter Bridgehampton. It's got enormously fat columns in the front. It's not what I would have designed for these people, but they had an image of what they wanted, mm-hmm. and I did the best with it. It took it's only a 20,000 square foot building, 30,000 if you count the basement. Mm-hmm. It took 2.5 years to build that.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's twice as long as it should have.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't find enough people who were qualified to do steel, then drywall, then brick, and so forth.
Yeah, what year was that?
That was starting construction in 1994.
Yeah.
We finished in 97.
Yeah.
Well, interesting experience.
Well, we have done a number of projects because they were so rural.
And, yeah, right.
And we built the majority of the house off-site.
I think it makes great sense.
Yes, yeah. Yes. In many locations it does.
Now, do you usually put these houses on grade beams, shallow spread footings?
Or, they are always
or
either
pilings.
On a basement is ideal. Uh-huh. If not a basement, a crawl space, and a number of them on piers we have done. We have done
sure.
them on concrete piers up in the Catskills where it's too rocky to dig
right.
the foundation.
Right.
And out in the sand where we've had to drive piers down into the sand, build a frame upon which the boxes sit.
Right.
So, but never on a slab because these are built, you know, as boxes, so they have a floor structure and a ceiling
sure.
structure, and they need to sit on a foundation.
I mean, slab on grade is kind of brutal for a house anyway. I mean, unless you're heating it, in which case you're also heating the earth, and unless you've got a lot of insulation under there,
yeah.
that's also slab is very hard underfoot.
Yeah, it can be.
Yeah.
It can be a beautiful thing, too, with radiant heat. It can be a...
Yeah, but you can do radiant with a framed floor also.
Yeah, absolutely. We do it very often.
Do you?
Absolutely.
Well, let's, in the next section, let's talk about pressures of budget and time.
Okay. My favorite.
Talking about the pressure of architecture with Joe Tanney, architect. You were telling me you've got a real one going.
A book?
And then I want to talk about the pressure of budget and time.
Yes, we have a real book in the works with Princeton Architectural
Press. Oh, yes, a real book. Okay.
And we were...
I thought you meant a real building, Joe.
Oh, yeah.
Well, a real building. You have some real buildings going right now?
Well, these aren't what you're looking at right there. They're not pretend.
They're not renderings.
They're not...
Currently,
we have a number of things going on, absolutely.
That's what I wanted to ask about.
Yes, we have a whole slew of things happening right now.
Well, so because you have this kit of parts that is well-developed, and you've got producers who are able to do this...
Mm-hmm. Fulfillment partners, we like to call them.
Aha!
Yes.
So if I was a savvy client, I would ask you, what's your kickback, Joe?
Oh, we don't get one.
Yeah, well...
We get hired... We don't get one. We get hired as architects by the client.
Right.
For each and every project we do, they hire us. We don't sell the boxes at all.
So how do they know that they're getting the best price for this box?
Well, we get signed up by telling them, here's what we believe the budget, here's what we should budget for your project.
Okay, so you'll take a point of view about budget.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's great.
That's the key to all of this.
Well, that's a brave new world of being architects, isn't it?
Well, that's one of the problems we have as a profession. I mean... to not know how much something's going to cost that we're designing.
Yes, but the AIA tells us in our standard agreement form that we shouldn't take a stand whatsoever about what it's going to cost,
and
which I take issue with.
Well, I can understand that as well. But over time and over with experience and having developed a methodology, a way, so it's a series of standards, and probably the most interesting thing is... By using this, by being on system, if you will, then we have a higher level of predictability.
Of course.
And so when a client comes in, we'll say, this range of projects, this was the range of costs, this is what we can expect in this particular location. And we'll go through line item generally, right? So you have the house, there's site work. There's a variety of things that go into a budget, into the scope of work to actually be able to complete it and meet certain expectations.
Sure, it's not just the house. There are site developments. And
that's right. There's driveways, there's septic, there's well, there's utilities.
Is it 30 miles up a gravel road?
That's
with,
right.
Yeah, has with no
difference.
Utilities?
Has sure. A, yeah, has a big difference on their overall budget. So,
but you track that information.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
It's very important because how else can a client develop trust and confidence in what it is that, you know, we design as architects. So
well, that's almost a rhetorical question. How would they? Well, as a matter of fact, they wouldn't, right?
Yes.
And that's one of the abiding legacies of the late 20th century in our profession, where so many architects say, that's not my job.
Well, and also our discipline.
But I'm glad to know that you're embracing that.
Absolutely.
As part and parcel of what you bring to raise the level of practice.
Yes, yes. And you know, in the academy, in our discipline, we're sort of trained to be always creating the new and pushing the envelope. And in the discipline or within the practice of the discipline, it's a different world because you can't get that stuff built unless we're coming in or at least close to budget. Just generally within the profession of architecture.
Right, so let's talk about budget. Construction only, excluding site work and bringing utilities to the building.
Well, on average...
100 bucks a square foot? 300 bucks a square foot?
Well, on average, the houses that you see...
Yes.
On average, they cost about 250 bucks a square foot. Half of that number, approximately 125 bucks a square foot, is what it costs to delivered from the factory. The other half of that 250, which is 125, is the site work, which is typically the foundation and the siding and the flooring and finishing it off. So
the site installed work.
The on-site work by the contractor to finish the house.
Right. Not site improvement work.
In addition, we talk about site costs, which under the title site costs, there's a driveway, septic, well, utilities. And often in that number is actually digging the hole for the foundation. Why? Because often it's the same contractor doing the driveway that's digging the hole.
Yeah, so, of course.
So generally those costs are, you know, 5 to 20% of one's construction cost, depending on the nature of the site. So on average, you know.
Really?
They vary.
Well, that's a big range, 5 to 20%.
But sites can be, a quarter acre, and sites could be 200 acres. Mm. We once did a house on 200 acres where we had to actually figure out how to get a driveway in and up and around, and it was so far off the beaten trail, we literally, the house is off the grid completely. There's no electricity, there's no cell service, there's nothing. So we designed the house. It was cheaper to go completely off the grid than to bring electricity to the site of this house. So
cool.
Every site is different. Every house is different. Every project's different.
Where was that house?
That one's in Vermont.
Really?
Yes. So they vary greatly.
Yeah.
So depending, we'll talk about if a client has X amount of dollars, we try to have a discussion about the nature of the site and actually then start to work backwards to subtract. Some people, they need a garage or not a garage. Garages have been, in our experience, 75 to 125 a foot. So you could budget, 50 to 80 grand for a garage. Decks are probably 30 to 40 bucks a square foot that you've seen here.
Yeah.
So there's
how much a square foot?
30 to 40 bucks a square foot.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
On average. And it's about the same as...
Well, these are the EPE decks you're talking about.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Okay.
The everlasting...
Yeah, I want to put FSC. A ban on ePay. I'm sorry. We really have... This is my own personal agenda. We really have to promote the use of North American black locust. And, it's a wave of the present. ePay is kind of like 15 years ago. It was great. Anyway, that's your practice. This is mine. You'll come around. You'll understand. We'll get it going.
Yeah, give me time.
When we have this deck done on 12th Street, I'll have you come over.
I would love to see it.
And you'll see what great stuff it is.
Okay.
If it's not great stuff, my job is gone. So does the method... Okay, you've explained that these stratagems for domestic response work out for, I'm supposing, for a certain kind of client. I mean, if somebody really wants a McMansion, you'd have to do...
No, we don't do
McMansions. You would have to do Katsura Pavilion.
We don't.
You know the plan McMansions. For Katsura? It's a small module, but it goes... do you remember Corbu's plan for the hospital in Venice? Okay, so there's a fairly narrow... module, but it's almost viral. It just goes everywhere.
Spreads.
Yeah, I mean, you could do a McMansion, but it would be like the South Fork Ranch in the Dallas TV show, where there were just modules going everywhere.
I don't know if we would do that project. Nobody would call us that would want anything close to a McMansion.
But you never know.
We've been fortunate. To attract a number of clients that have a kindred spirit with
and they want that.
What they see.
And
not
okay.
Exactly, but generally, right? It's lean, it's clean, it's green.
But what about breaking the box? Can you break the box?
Well,
can you break the corners?
I will say that...
Do you want to break the corners?
Well, turning the corner is one of our preoccupations, absolutely. Turning the corner in many ways, either with materiality, with space... with view.
That's so Mies. You know, Mies is all about turning the corner.
We're old school as well.
Okay. How do you turn the corner?
I will say...
But not with a cantilevered window.
But I will say that in terms of breaking the box, I will say that our efforts have definitely gone into thinking inside the box in terms of contiguous relationships of these essential elements of domesticity, in terms of how to arrange a space so it's most efficient and lives larger than it actually is. When the program grows, then we begin to assemble these modules. So we talked a little bit about the conceptual building blocks, those being the modules of use. Well,
right.
The actual implementation, the actual fabrication of the modules, isn't necessarily a one-to-one correspondence.
Yeah, okay, understood. I'm just pressing here.
Mm-hmm.
Because it has to be good radio. I have to press you. I don't want you to get all mad or something and make me have to play Hendrix Hey Joe,
I hope you got that keyed up.
I don't. Maybe the maybe if you come back, we'll pretend it's professional wrestling.
Okay.
And we'll have an argument.
Okay.
And then we can play that. But and I thought about it, but I hadn't met you. I didn't know what your sense of humor was.
Very little, as you can tell.
I don't know about that. No, but what about breaking the corners? I mean, can you break the corners of these modules?
Well, you know, breaking the corner, you can do it physically. You can do it visually. You can do it in a number of ways. So we don't necessarily think of breaking the corner as much as we think of turning the corner.
Uh-huh.
And so we do that both from the outside but from the inside. But
you realize
our focus, our efforts have been designing from the inside out. So we haven't been as preoccupied with breaking the corner as we have with this efficiency of use, this efficiency of implementation, and this efficiency of performance. So these homes, very similar to all the lofts that we've done, are designed from the inside out with that as a focus.
Yeah, but you understand that there are some of our profession who really have a craving to erode the corners of space,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To somehow engage the corners with landscape or
yes.
something beyond.
Yes, and we attempt to do that at varying degrees.
Okay.
Like, for example, one of the long linear compositions of private spaces, we'll call it a private module. You go to the top of the stairs, a long linear corridor with a series of bedrooms and bathrooms. At the end of that corridor, depending on the nature of the site, we might have a wall and release the rest of the walls with glass. Uh-huh. Or at the end of that corridor, we might turn the corner with glass, depending on the view, depending on the solar orientation, depending on the specificity of the site.
Let me ask you about glass. Do these come from the factory pre-glazed or not?
Yes.
They do?
Yes. To get the highest value proposition, the windows are installed in the factory. In other words, if you don't install the windows in the factory, you're not going to have a watertight box. Right, so to get all the sheetrock, all the insulation, all the cabinets, counters, tile, everything done in the factory, they need to be shipped as watertight as possible.
As a unitized module.
Yes. Now, that said, there are, because we do compose and assemble and have an aggregate of various modules depending on the site and depending on the client's program, mm-hmm. so there's more than one module gets put together. Because one thing I don't know if we actually talked about, the limits being 16 feet wide but 11 high and often 60 long.
Didn't talk about 11, no.
Yeah, because there's a height limit in addition to the width.
That's a pretty good height, though.
Generally.
Well, that's gross height.
That's right.
So if there's a second story, we're talking 9'6" maybe once you...
Generally 9 feet.
All right.
9 feet. Generally 9 feet is the... Now, some of them we've... shipped them open on top and placed another butterfly or another module on top to gain ceiling height. We've done this a few times as well.
Uh-huh. A structural module
mm-hmm.
in between.
Another module on top.
Another module that's structural that sits yes. on top of yep. the stud plates?
Yes, yes.
Cool.
Yes.
Excellent.
To gain height.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
When
so required.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. How do you join these modules together in plan section?
You know, that's a question we get so often, the connections. And what's interesting, at one level, they're incredibly simple, and at other levels, they're very complex. In other words, if it's on the water or in a hurricane zone,
yeah.
the connections are at a higher level in that there's many hold downs, there's a series of straps, there's
right.
a series of bolting patterns, there's a... You know, we have a structural engineer that, depending on the location and the wind loads and required, you know, we'll put together almost a phone book of calculations for approval, because these get approved by the state because they send an inspector to the factory. So in addition to all the local permits and inspectors we have, once the boxes have been set, we also have to get systems built approval by the state wherever we're building. So we have to submit a whole series of plans, structural calculations.
So theoretically, a Pennsylvania inspector is reviewing the manufactured
product. It's a third party. It's a third party inspection system. So there's a whole system already set up. So the same way with the inspections and the permits and the approvals, but there's also a financial system set up too by the banks to offer loans, because the process is a little bit different than a site-built home.
Who's doing third-party review for on behalf of the banks?
Well, the third-party review isn't necessarily on behalf of the banks. What I was talking about is that there's systems set up for the modular industry.
Okay.
Even though it's a small percentage of the overall homes that are done, it's
I only ask that because I, for several years, did third-party reviews on behalf of construction lenders.
I see.
Reviewing the work of you and me in another life,
yeah,
for very large projects in and around the Northeast.
I see.
Mostly.
Yeah, this third party I was talking about was specifically for the permits to get the check mark to say, yes, this is built to code and can get built in this factory, and the factory is building it to code.
What's that called? What's that organization called? I'm curious.
I'm blanking on it right now. You'll
have to come back and you'll have to tell us who's inspecting and reviewing, because part of this is sharing the knowledge, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
Okay, good. Let's take a little break. Very little break. A minute and a half. Burning Down the House. I'm Curtis B. Wayne here with Joe Tanney from Resolution 4 Architecture, Res 4, firm in New York City. We've been talking about his firm's development of use typologies, technology to build buildings at a competitive price. What we didn't talk about is design process yet. We've got just a couple minutes left. Does this speed up the design process? I mean, ordinarily with a house, you could spend a year with a family.
Yes. The process, the overall process, is generally four phases of 4 months each, where the first phase, we spend a lot of time with the client and design the entire house, every window. We understand what's operable, every cabinet, what are drawers, doors, every faucet, every outlet location, everything in that first phase. So
of how many months?
Four months.
Okay.
And we put together a set of documents that are about 80% CDs at that time that we issue to the factory for preliminary pricing.
Okay.
So during that second phase of 4 months, we spent a lot of time with the factory doing engineering and coordination to get those state systems built approvals, while at the same time we're finishing off a set of drawings to go out to bid to a local GC. So although 80% of the house is built in a factory, we still need a local licensed GC that's responsible for the home. So one of your questions back when, we get hired, we get 15% of the construction costs for architectural services. And then the client, when we go out to bid at the end of phase two, we administer...
Wait. Stop. Your fee's 15%?
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
And we administer the contract. We go
people
out to
don't
bid.
Argue about that.
No, it's
excellent.
It's also a very good value proposition as well. When they, at the end of the day, what they get for what they get for what they pay, it's a high value proposition. So, at the end of phase two, we've gone out to bid, get a local GC.
Yeah.
We got all our permits in place. That starts phase three.
You're eight months into that yeah. at that point. Okay.
Phase three simultaneously is the fabrication process and the site prep. In other words, on site, the GC's digging a hole, putting in the utilities, septic well,
sure.
foundation, getting the site ready.
Yeah.
And in the factory, it starts with first the procurement process, which takes 8 to 10 weeks. They order all the windows, cabinets, counters, tile, everything.
When does that start?
At the beginning of phase three, when we got all our permits and everything ready to go, got a contractor on board, everything's in line. That starts, and then once all the stuff shows up, and it's scheduled at the beginning of phase three. It's about 8 to 12 weeks out that we get a line space, that we're online, we get in line, if you will, because again, these factories are assembly line methodology by which they build these. In other words, the guys stay in one location, the houses move, so you have stations.
Yeah, sure, like a car.
And it only takes about 2 weeks to build the house in the factory, and then it goes out in the yard for about another 2 weeks where some of the countertops are templated or some of the tiles finished off.
Uh-huh.
And then it's shipped, and that starts phase four, and a big crane is there. Usually takes about a day to set the boxes, depending on how many there are. We've done as simple as one, like Steve's house, and as many as 8, I think, recently for a house on Fire Island.
Do you ever stack them too high? You can't.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. We stack them too high. Absolutely.
If you're not going under bridges or something.
Oh, well, they're shipped individually.
Oh, okay.
And then on site.
That's what I was asking.
Yes.
For shipping, they have to go one high.
Yes. Yes. Okay. And that's what the limit.
It's 11 feet.
Yeah,
right.
Because they sit on carriers, they're 30 inches.
Right.
You could use low boys and get a little bit more, but generally, this is the way the industry set up.
Again. Do you ever ship by rail?
No, because they're too wide, but we have shipped by barge.
So you could ship something much wider by barge, I think.
You can.
I would imagine.
Except you still have to adhere to. You got to get it to the barge. In other words, we did it once, shipping it from Pennsylvania, goes down the highway, has to adhere to all the local. But we put it on a barge, and what was interesting about that project is we had it designed to the limits of the barge, too. We only wanted one barge. So we had it designed to the limits of the budget, limits of the site constraints, and limits of the barge.
Do you recall how wide a barge is? How many modules could you fit on? Width-wise on a barge?
We were able to get 2 wide, I believe, if I remember correctly.
But you could go as high as you'd like, I suppose.
And another one, we've had to design thinner to get on the ferry. In other words, so we literally, with a tape measure measuring the ferry. I mean, you make a number of phone calls first, but...
You mean like Martha's Vineyard or Nantucket?
This one was Fisher's Island. Martha's Vineyard was a barge, although you can take the ferry as well if you design them within the limits,
right?
Which are, 12 to 14. And then that last phase is that when we spend a lot of time on site with the contractor, we go to the job site maybe once every 2 weeks, depends on where it is and the scale of the project.
Right.
When he puts on the siding and the flooring and HVAC and installs decks.
So your whole process is 16 months.
16 months, that's typical. We've had some projects go longer, and we've had a number of projects go faster. They all
vary.
That's
typical.
That's typical.
That's pretty good.
And those are, yes.
That is a value proposition.
Well, we would like to think so.
We've been talking about the new modern modular with Joe Tenney from Res4, Resolution for Architecture. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. This is Burning Down the House on Heritage Radio Network. Thank you for listening. Keep the faith.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.